To the left of the Democratic Party in this
country. 10 seconds for this other three guests. Michelle Goldberg, right now, as we wrap up, your comment on what you want to see happen in this next year.
What I want to see happen is for people to organize within the Democratic Party to pull Hillary Clinton to the left, because I think that, for better or for worse, she is responsive
Robert
to political Scheer, pressure.
8 seconds.
Yeah, I supported Obama, and it was easier to challenge the government when Bush was president than when Obama was president. So it is not good for democracy to have a lesser evil as our candidate.
Krishama Savant.
I would like to see Bernie Sanders run as an independent political anti-corporate alternative to Democrats and Republicans. And I would like the support of the left for me to win my re-election, because that is absolutely critical for the left.
We're going to have to leave it there. Krishama Savant, socialist alternative city council member in Seattle. Joe Connison, editor-in-chief of the National Memo. Thank you so much to Nation writer Michelle Goldberg and to Robert Scheer, who's author of They Know Everything About You. And that does it for the show. Happy birthday to Anna Osbeck. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
In coordinating a community.
We are Trayvon.
KBOO is proud to support the African American Alliance in collaboration with the YWCA of Greater Portland in coordinating a community unity event featuring special guests, Mrs. Sabrina Fulton, mother of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, who was attacked and murdered in 2012. Mrs. Fulton will share her powerful inspirational message on empowering our youth. The program will be held on Monday, April 13th from 6:45 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at Maranatha Church. Please plan to arrive by 6:15 since seating is limited. This program will include spoken word, poetry, and music from our youth and other community members. Monday, April 13th, 6:45 p.m. at Maranatha Church, 4222 Northeast 12th Avenue, Portland, Oregon.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 6th annual Sold Out Music Festival, April 14th to the 20th. This year's festival has significant focus on Portland, Northwest, and West Coast artists throughout the lineup, as well as headliners Charles Bradley, Kimbra, Yasiin Bey, both solo and singing for Bad Brains, and many more. This year's festival takes place in 11 venues across Portland. Again, that's the 6th annual Sold Out Music Festival, April 14th through the 20th, in 11 venues across Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
The time is 5:03 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland residents gathered outside the Mexican consulate to protest the Mexican government's handling of the students who disappeared last fall.
Nestle has plans for a bottling plant in the Columbia River Gorge.
And President Obama met with Cuban President Raúl Castro, marking the first time heads of state have come together since 1961.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 13th, 2015. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Plans to clean a stretch of the Willamette River in Portland are in the works once again, according to an update last Thursday at the Northwest Environmental Business Council. The Willamette has been part of a federal cleanup plan called the Portland Harbor Superfund since 2000. Currently, the EPA is scheduled to finish a cleanup plan by 2016. The plan includes a stretch of the Willamette from the Broadway Bridge to the Columbia River along Portland's industrial areas. Cleanup plans have been in the works for many years, but now look to have a much more viable chance of starting. At Thursday's meeting, Alex Liverman of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality presented a look at some of the Superfund's completed work and some of the more complicated work in the future. Portland Harbor supports a large economy and around 17,000 jobs. The Willamette River was listed as a federal Superfund site because of its heavy contamination from industrial activity along the riverside.
Last Friday, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife applied to transfer its water rights to Cascade Locks. The application opens the door for a Nestle bottling company in Oxbow Springs. The organization, BARC, is taking action to stop the transfer of water rights. KBOO's Eric Takedoff spoke with BARC's executive director, Alex Brown, about the deal and their plans to keep Nestle out of Oregon.
Could you describe exactly what is happening in Oxbow Springs?
Sure. 6 years ago, Nestle came to our region and was seeking a source of spring water for its Arrowhead bottle brand. This is a brand that only takes spring water, and what they found in the Columbia River Gorge was Oxbow Springs, a source of crystal clear spring water that flows out of the ground just outside of the boundary of Mount Hood National Forest within the Columbia River Gorge. And when they realized that the water was currently being used by the state, specifically the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, for the Oxbow Springs fish hatchery, Nestle found a way to get at that water, and that was to have the city of Cascade Locks propose a water exchange with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife such that approximately 100 million gallons a year of spring water would be exchanged to the city of Cascade Locks that they could then sell to the Nestle company to bottle for its Arrowhead Springwater brand.
Was there any benefit to this water exchange as far as the city of Cascade Locks went?
Well, from the beginning, the city of Cascade Locks has pointed to the jobs issue. And obviously, in 2008, 2009, the jobs issue was a much bigger one than it is right now. There has been some significant improvements in the city of Cascade Locks with respect to community development and economic development. They still want jobs. Everyone does. But the original number was touted as 50 new jobs. And what has been so challenging, and this is very common in these deals with Nestle, is that nobody can actually pin them down to exactly how many jobs and exactly who's going to get these jobs and what kind of jobs they're going to be. And so that 50 number is kind of the top, we think. When you really push hard, that number tends to start decreasing. And so that was the original intent for the city of Cascade Locks to benefit. And the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the big question is, why are they involved and what do they get out of that? And the answer really is nothing. They get water in return, but what they're doing is becoming a partner with one of the companies in the world that is not known as being a particularly easy partner to get along with. And so how much benefit the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is going to get is a big question mark. More importantly, this water is currently public. It's state water. It's for the benefit of state resources.
So in opposition to some of those economic concerns or the environmental concerns, do you know anything about Nestle's track record in other areas where they have bottling plants?
Nestle's track record is not very good, and there is a slew of information on the internet about what happens when Nestle enters a community. In the case of the Pacific Northwest, Nestle is not here yet. they have been rejected multiple times by multiple different communities when they've tried to come in and use their water. Now, the environmental concerns are more than just dealing with a potentially bad actor with the Nestle company. It has to do with the fact that to transport those 100 million gallons of spring water every year, we're talking about ultimately billions of plastic water bottles, which, as everyone knows here, is in the Pacific Northwest and throughout the West, where people are conscious about the effect of those bottles, is a really important issue for us to be aware of, too. And Oregon being a major supporter of the creation of that waste seems out of touch with what Oregonians want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so Cascade Locks is bypassing public consideration with this water swap, but that seems to point to support in opposition to this plan, because why else would they want to bypass public opinion?
So that's the issue that we're dealing with today. Right now, we have a state government who, for the last 5 years, has received, we believe, around just under 100,000 comments from Oregonians opposing the giveaway of our public water to support a Nestle water bottling plant. And you would think that the government response would be to rethink what they were doing. Instead, what happened on Friday is that the previous water exchange application would have exchanged water, but it would not have exchanged water rights. And this was actually a proposal that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife rejected 5 years ago when this was originally proposed. They said, we're not comfortable permanently giving away water rights. We're going to pursue this water exchange anyway. This was all under Governor Kulongoski.
And actually, if we could talk a little bit about California and the West and the drought that that they are currently experiencing, how that's related to Nestle's bottling plant here in Oregon.
So one of the things that Nestle is known for is that when there are times of crisis in any community in which they're bottling, they do not respond the same way that the community responds. That's exactly what's happening in Sacramento, California right now. Nestle has a contract to bottle a certain amount of water, and whereas the state is telling everyone, don't water your lawns and to restrict your water use for these reasons. That's not what they're doing in Sacramento. It's led to protests. And this is exactly the kind of behavior that we don't want to see in the Pacific Northwest. If they get their foot in the door in the Columbia River Gorge in Cascade Locks, it's likely that we are going to have Nestle will be our neighbor for decades to come. And what's happening in California will sure enough happen in Oregon and Washington in the near future.
That was Alex Brown, the executive director of BARC. For KBOO News, this is Eric Tegetoff.
BARC will be holding a rally on Wednesday at their offices at 5 p.m. to keep Nestle out of Oregon. Go to bark-out.org to find out more information about the rally.
Around 100 Portland residents gathered outside the Mexican consulate this morning to protest the failure of the Mexican government to bring justice to the families of 43 students who disappeared last September. The government has changed its story several times as to what happened to the students and to the involvement of Mexican authorities. They blame the disappearance on drug gangs, but witnesses said the students were taken by local police. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with the mother of one of the 43 students who disappeared. The interview took place outside the Mexican consulate in Portland this morning.
Nosotros tenemos la voz y nosotros podemos cambiarlo. Porque el gobierno está, porque el pueblo lo puso. Pero el pueblo lo puede quitar a la hora que quiera.
Can you tell us what your main message is for the people of Portland as to what you want their help with?
Nos ayuden a protestar y exigirle a este gobierno que alto al plan Mérida.
That they help us to protest and to demand that this government stops Plan Mérida, the Mérida initiative. And can you talk about what is the Plan Mérida and how it's impacted your communities?
¿Puede hablar de lo que es el Plan Mérida y cómo ha impactado a sus comunidades? Pues yo tengo entendido que ese plan le mandan recursos a México para según combatir la delincuencia, pero no la están combatiendo, a la contra. Se están sirviendo de ese recurso para comprarle armas a los militares, a los policías, para matarnos, para reprimirnos.
From what I understand, it's a plan that is provides resources to supposedly fight organized crime, but that's not what they're really using it for. On the contrary, they're using it to buy weapons for the policemen and the soldiers, and they're using those weapons to kill us.
Has the government closed its investigation of the disappearance of your son and the other youth?
Pues para él, él rápido lo quería cerrar. Él luego no lo quería cerrar el caso. ¿Cómo no lo va a cerrar? Si no nos ha dado prueba de nada. No lo puede cerrar porque no nos ha dado prueba de nada.
They wanted to close it very fast as they could. And how is that possible that they close it? Because they don't have proof of anything at all.
Have you thought about going to the International Criminal Court to take the Mexican government to trial for their involvement?
Pues de eso sí se encargan los abogados y me parece que ya fueron o van a ir.
That's what our lawyers are working on, and it seems to me that they, I think they already went or they're going to go.
And what about the U.S. government? What are you demanding that U.S. officials do?
Que, como le dije, alto al Plan Mérida y que presione al gobierno de allá. Él sabe cómo, porque él sabe que el gobierno de allá depende mucho de los bolsillos del gobierno de acá. Y que él presione con eso a que nos entregue a nuestros hijos. Y que no los entregue vivo, porque los tiene vivo.
Halt to the Merida plan, and also that this government puts pressure on Mexico, because they know how to do it. Mexico depends very much on the pockets of the United States, so in that way they can pressure Mexico to return our children and return them alive, because they have them alive.
Is it your belief then that all of the students are still alive and they're being held somewhere?
Sí, yo sí lo creo. Eso sí lo creo yo. Que los tienen vivo. Porque no hay ni uno que esté muerto. No hay ni una prueba que salga positivo de que están muertos. Ellos están vivos. Y los tienen en algún lugar guardado. Ahí los tienen escondido. Por eso tenemos que dar con ellos.
Yes, that is what I believe, because there isn't a single shred of proof that they are dead. So that is what we believe, that they are hidden away somewhere, that they have them somewhere, and they're keeping them there. That's why it's so important for us to find them.
And what do you hope this caravan through the U.S. will accomplish?
Pues yo tengo mucha esperanza de que dé muy buen resultado, que la gente haga conciencia y esto sirva de algo para presionar allá.
I have a lot of hope that this is going to be really useful for raising people's consciousness, and that the government will be pressured in Mexico.
Pero vengan a ver, ese no es presidente, es una rata en el poder.
Could you introduce yourself and the organization that you're with?
Sure. My name is Patty Moran, and I'm a member of the collective Somos 43 Solidarios.
And what's been the involvement of the Latino community here in the Portland area in this issue?
Well, there have been lots of organizations that have had events around this issue. There have been some marches, and the group that I'm a part of, the collective, started doing some fundraising specifically to bring the parents and the surviving students here, because it's part of a nationwide coalition. And so our collective joined that. It's called Frente Ayotzinapa USA. And so we started fundraising to create awareness in the Latino community about this issue, and also to get the support financially that we needed to bring them out here, because we didn't want the government or any nonprofits to be, you know, in charge of this. We wanted the community itself to stand up and make this happen.
And how has Plan Merida and the war on drugs been used to repress activists in Mexico?
Well, from what I've seen, is it's been used as a scapegoat and a way to neutralize the activism and the community asking questions and trying to find out, you know, what's happening with the government and what's happening in Mexico.
And this teacher's college, the students were a part of that was attacked, was involved in community organizing, I understand. Was that part of why they were attacked?
That's what the families and the students have said at these conferences that we've had, is that historically there's been a long a history of social activism from that school and the teachers that have been trained. If you go back to Lucio Cabañas from the 70s, he was a leader that came out from that school. So the students from that school are very active in the community and demanding justice and the resources for their education, and so that's why the government has had them on their radar for decades.
Have you managed to get any coverage by mainstream media outlets?
Here in Portland?
Yeah.
Well, Univision is here, it's Spanish media, but from the English one, no.
Those were the voices of protesters who gathered outside the Mexican consulate in Portland this morning. For more information on the movement for justice for the 43 disappeared students, you can go to caravana43.com.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for hearings that took place today in Salem about a bill to increase minimum wage, followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, Adam Carpinelli will interview Delphine Crescenzo and Jackie Malmstrom of Rose City Native Radio on Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for an 80% chance of rain. The high is 55 and the low is 39. Today in history. In 1919, British troops massacred hundreds of unarmed men, women, and children who were attending a peaceful gathering in Punjab, India. And in much happier news, a Happy New Year to our friends from Thailand. Let the water dousing begin. The quote of the day is from Benjamin Franklin. When the well runs dry, they will know the worth of water.
Four ex-contractors of the formerly named Blackwater Military contracting firm were sentenced this morning for crimes during the U.S. invasion of Iraq. 7 years ago, Nicholas Slatton, Evan Liberty, Dustin Hurd, and Paul Slough massacred 14 Iraqi civilians and injured many more in Nisour Square, Baghdad. Slatton was sentenced to life in prison, while the other three received sentences of no less than 30 years. The Blackwater Corporation continues to contract out security officers under the name Academy.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Striking doctors at the University of California picketed UCLA campuses over the weekend and will be there again Monday. Doctors are striking at all 10 UC campuses. The Union of American Physicians and Dentists, UAPD, has filed unfair labor practice charges against UC. The doctors have been trying to negotiate a first union contract for a year. Students and fellow UC workers are joining the striking student health doctors on the picket lines. The doctors have launched a new website, uchealthexposed.org, to communicate about student health services issues at UC. Gallup polls show that 53% of Americans approve of unions, but private sector union density, the percentage of the workforce in unions, is just 7% in the U.S. UNI Global Labor Union Federation General Secretary Philip Jennings told the UN recently that aggressive anti-union actions created by employers and some politicians makes organizing unions a battle in the U.S. Here's a clip from what Jennings said, courtesy of Radio Labor.
We're in the United States of America, the world's number one economy. This is the worst place in the Western Hemisphere in terms of getting access to workers, discussing with workers, having a fair opportunity to say to them, would you like union representation?
This is Mitch Lawrence with the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. There are a few lessons to be learned from the horrible incident during which the Indiana Pacers' Chris Copeland was stabbed in the stomach and elbow outside of a New York City nightclub the other day. First off, there's the old saying about nothing good happening after midnight. In this case, they were well beyond the midnight hour when Copeland and his ex-fiancée were attacked by a knife-wielding man. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. Now, we all know that NBA players are grown men and they are treated that way. There's no curfew for any teams in the league, and there shouldn't be. But to be out at 4 o'clock in the morning, especially when you've got a game that very night, well, that's a problem. even if you are a seldom-used backup like Copeland, who was recovering from his injuries. Here's another lesson that had to be learned the hard way. Two players for the Atlanta Hawks were also on the scene when Copeland was attacked. The Hawks, Thabo Sebolosha and Pero Antic, were arrested because when New York City police officers arrived on the scene, these two players did not allow the cops to establish a crime scene. So they were charged with resisting arrest, obstruction of justice, and disorderly conduct. That's obviously not very good. Here's the bottom line to the Copeland incident. All these players were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And there's no doubt they all put themselves there. With a Sports Minute for Workers Independent News, this is Mitch Lawrence.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Do you have a nanny cam in your home? If so, did you know that this camera can be hacked? The hackers then have the ability to point the camera, speak to the people in the rooms, and post photos on websites. A Minnesota family heard, quote, creepy music, unquote, playing through the speakers of their nanny cam. When they went into their baby's room to check on the music, it turned off. Then, they turned the camera to face the wall, only to discover a few hours later that the camera had repositioned itself. An actual nanny fled from a house where she had been caring for a child when she heard a man speaking to her from the camera. A Houston couple found that someone was speaking obscene words to their child through their nanny cam. Some of the people who've discovered their cameras were hacked have been able to track down the hacker through the companies providing the cameras. They often discover a website that displays thousands of photos of the interior of people's homes in the kitchen, bedrooms, living rooms, and more. If you're going to use a nanny cam, security experts recommend that users should frequently change the camera's network password and username. They also recommend keeping a close eye on the IP logs, looking for any unfamiliar addresses. And they recommend that you make sure the baby monitor is connected only to an encrypted network. Some couples have decided they'd feel more secure if they disconnected the nanny cam and just started watching their children with their own eyes.
Harassment of manatees by visitors is out of control in Florida Warm Spring parks, according to agency records posted today by Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. In addition, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which manages national wildlife refuges, does not analyze reports of harassment incidents. In a candid email sent last year, the outgoing Kings Bay Manatee Refuge manager, Michael Lusk, wrote that the amount of unregulated activity in the refuge is likely resulting in the harassment and endangerment of manatees. That email was released today as part of a document released by Public Employees for Social Responsibility, known by their acronym PEER. In his email, Lusk pointed out that activities by an uneducated public are likely resulting in the endangerment of manatees inside the springs. Increasingly, visitors react to warnings from refuge staff and volunteers with animosity and abusive language. He also cautioned that increased law enforcement presence is needed to stem what he called potentially dangerous situations involving physical violence by tourists visiting the endangered manatee site. He recommended that the service should close the springs while manatees are present to prevent the endangerment of the animals. His conclusions echo a note of intent to sue the service, recently filed by PEER, to end swim with programs, which enable thousands of tourists to swarm the narrow, shallow, warm water springs habitat that the manatees live in and need to survive. Also obtained under the Freedom of Information Act are the first tabulations of manatee harassment incidents that the Fish and Wildlife Service has assembled after it established a dedicated email address this January to receive citizen reports. Since that time, the agency has issued 10 citations and another 8 cases remain under criminal investigation. The Service Information Officer stipulated, however, that the agency has undertaken no review or analysis of these incidents.
It's 5:29, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It doesn't take highly advanced knowledge and skills to work at one of these quick-fix automobile maintenance chains that specialize in routine jobs like muffler replacement or oil changes. But handling maintenance at a huge petrochemical complex is a whole other story. An oil refinery is not a Jiffy Lube. But the big shots of big oil have been treating maintenance at their explosive refineries as a task to be done on the cheap. BP, ExxonMobil, Motiva, Tesoro, and other global oil profiteers have been cutting back on the experienced, technically skilled people responsible for keeping the miles of pipes, high-pressure equipment, bulky gauges, and flammable liquids functioning properly and, most important, harmlessly. The top bosses, safely ensconced in faraway corporate headquarters, have decreed that maintenance and safety be contracted out to low-cost firms using temporary, inexperienced, inadequately trained workers. The impact of trying to save money on safety has been, well, explosive. Two occupational safety experts, Celeste Monforton and Barbara Bakke, report that once every 8 days, a serious fire, explosion, or toxic release takes place at a U.S. refinery. Death happens when bosses play with fire. And that's why the United Steelworkers Union has been on strike at refineries across the country. None of us wants to be the next person to lose his life for no good reason, says a refinery worker on the picket line in Anacortes, Washington. Of course, Big Oil's bosses dismissed the danger. Motiva's CEO, Don Renasco, glibly said that the strike is not about safety, but about increasing the number of union jobs. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, yeah. Union maintenance workers know how to do the job right. I'll bet if we moved Don's office inside the refinery, safety would suddenly become priority number one.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
At the regional summit of the Americas last Saturday, President Obama met with Cuban President Raul Castro in Panama for the first in-person meeting between the two nations' heads of state since 1961. While the two made progress toward establishing close ties, there still remain fundamental differences between their national interests. Castro clarified that Havana's main goals were to lift the U.S. embargo on Cuba and to have the U.S. return Guantanamo Bay, which he highlighted is still illegally occupied by U.S. military forces. Furthermore, Havana wishes that Washington re-examines the policy that regards Cuba as a terrorist threat. He went on to say he has no intention of ending communist rule in Cuba. Obama says he is hoping to establish an embassy in Havana and will ask Congress to consider removing Cuba from the terrorist threat list. Despite expressing frustration about the difficult history in the Gulf, Castro spoke well of Obama, saying that, in my opinion, Obama is an honest man. I admire him, he went on, also stating that we are willing to discuss everything, but we need to be patient, very patient.
Students at the University of Quebec in Montreal have been protesting austerity cuts made by the provincial government of Quebec. These protests began 3 weeks ago. The turmoil escalated when the protesters were ordered not to block the entrances to the university. In an unprecedented move, the university administration has called in the police to deal with the protesters. KBOO's Rosalind Scott spoke with Catherine Robinson, a student at the University of Quebec.
Catherine, you're protesting austerity cuts to your school that were made by the provincial government. Specifically, what changes has this made to the university and in the classroom?
We had a two-week strike that started 2 weeks before Easter, and that was 2 weeks that was voted by La Fesh and La Fea to be solidaire with the workers because of the measures of austerity that are starting right now since this summer. So we just wanted to show our support and take the time to tell the public that we're not that we're upset with all of the changes and how it's affecting not only the professors and the chargé cool, but also all of the workers on the work field right now, and of course the students. But then we voted to go on a longer strike on the Monday after Easter. It's actually a grève générale illimitée, which would be a strike, unlimited strike. So right now we're on strike until the rector of the university gets to stop expulsing students from the school right now for stopping the classes from happening because we're on strike. So we've decided to be solidaire with them and make sure we're on strike until they get to come back to the school. Right now it's very, very tense inside the school because in between students and professors and the administration, because this is the first time that the director has taken force into his own hands and actually gotten the police inside the school. So this is a complete change for LUCAM. This has never happened in LUCAM, in the whole history of LUCAM, and everybody's very upset.
Well, how many students are involved in this protest overall?
Well, right now, it's going on in Montreal, just in LUCAM. The two main associations that are on strike right now are La Fêche and La Faya. So we would be talking about around like 8,000 students.
Are involved in the protest.
No. Yeah.
And then what is the position for the professors? How are they affected by this, and what is their action that they're taking?
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying before, is that a lot of the professors are actually on the side of the students that are on strike are very cooperative. Like, it's always been a big cooperative between the students and the professors. Like, when we make sure the courses don't happen, there's not a big violence, there's no confrontation. It's just like students going into classes, reminding students that we're on strike, and then people leaving. But what's been happening now, since the police are inside the school, now the professors are very worried, and their union is telling them to make sure they can keep giving their classes, but at the same time, they're not supposed to be giving classes if less than half the class is there. But the university, the administration, is trying to tell them, well, right now, because of the climate, you have to give your classes, even if there's like only a small percentage of the class that's in there. It's very, very tense for them. And just today, 184 professors just disassociated themselves from the position of their union. So they're openly saying that it's not that they're against the strike, but they're against the strike inside the school and the stopping of the classes. And they're not, and they actually support, these 184 professors are actually supporting the decision of the rector of the university to put in the police officer, the police force. So this is it's really, really divided right now amongst the students and the professors.
Are the professors the ones that went and kept the confrontation from the police and the students? Are they the ones that calmed it down?
Yeah, but calming down is a big overstatement, because it really was a horrifying sight. There were police officers everywhere, and we definitely know that, yes, the professors are the ones that went between the police officers and the students, and this was on last Wednesday. And yeah, so it was a really, really traumatic experience for a lot of people. A lot of people got arrested. I think around 21 people were arrested and got severe fines, yes, for doing so.
What are the student plans for continuing this protest?
Tomorrow there's actually a general assembly for the students in La Fêche, so the human sciences department. So we're going to decide tomorrow. Everybody's going to decide if we keep on going for this strike, or if we're going to go back to our classes, because it's officially illegal, because the school has gotten an injonction. I'm sorry, how can I say this? It's they went to court to make sure that we can get support from the law. They've officially made it illegal for us to protest inside the school right now and to stop the classes from happening. So tomorrow we're going to hear all of the students in La Fêche to hear what they think, and if they think we should keep being on strike, mobilizing and keep the discussion going in amongst not only students and the student body, but the whole population of Quebec and Canada. And it's very hard right now because we're you know, a minority. Compared to 2012, it is not the same climate as 2012. We're not in the same spirit right now.
We've been speaking with Catherine Robinson. She is a student involved in the protest at the University of Quebec in Montreal. The students are protesting austerity cuts that have been initiated by the provincial government of Quebec. This is Rosalind Scott for KBOO News. A robot specially designed to handle high levels of radiation stopped responding after just 3 hours inside the reactor number 1 building at Fukushima. 4 nuclear reactors at Fukushima melted down in the aftermath of the 2011 Japanese earthquake and tsunami. Since then, due to extreme levels of radiation, officials at Fukushima have been unable to enter the reactor buildings to determine the exact location of the highly radioactive melted fuel cores. The robot, developed by International Research Institute for Nuclear Decommissioning, along with the Hitachi General Electric Corporation, was equipped with a dosimeter to measure radiation levels, a camera, a thermometer, and a laser scanner. The robot, built specifically to withstand extreme levels of radioactivity, made it about 2/3 of the distance towards the primary containment vessel before it stopped responding and died. Many experts believe that the fuel cores are in the basement subfloor area after melting through the primary containment vessel floor. The developers hope to use the robot to inspect the damage to the reactor buildings to help develop a decommissioning and cleanup plan. Last week, the head of TEPCO, the owner of the Fukushima nuclear power plant, admitted it could be hundreds of years before the technology could be developed that would allow entrance into the reactor buildings to decommission the nuclear fuel. Upwards of 400 tons of highly radioactive water is flowing into the nearby Pacific Ocean daily. This has led to many nuclear experts to conclude the nuclear fuel cores have largely melted through the basement containment floor into the bedrock and aquifer. This process is known as the China syndrome.
A new report in the journal Science blames ocean acidification for the largest extinction event ever to occur on Earth. Researchers now believe that ocean acidification from supervolcanoes erupting in Siberia 250 million years ago caused the Earth's largest extinction event. Known as the Great Dying, the event caused the extinction of over 96% of all marine species and 70% of all terrestrial species. It was much worse than the extinction event that caused dinosaurs to disappear from the Earth. The study was conducted by researchers from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. As supervolcanoes erupted in Siberia 250 million years ago, large amounts of carbon dioxide were released and absorbed by the world's oceans. The study found that current carbon emissions are being released at a rate similar to the rate that caused the Great Dying extinction event 250 million years ago. As carbon dioxide mixes with seawater, it creates carbonic acid. The absorption of carbon dioxide in seawater causes the chemical composition of the oceans to change, becoming much more acidic. The oceans of the world have absorbed almost half of the carbon dioxide emitted by humans from the burning of fossil fuels since the onset of the Industrial Revolution. Over the last 200 years, the world's oceans have become 30% more acidic, harming coral reefs and dissolving the shells of numerous species of shellfish, disrupting feeding and migratory patterns of sea life. Another study released last year by researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara, also warned of a possible mass extinction event for the world's oceans due to current rates of acidification. That study listed 9 environmental boundaries considered essential to the world's environmental health. 4 of the boundaries have been crossed in the last few centuries, causing the scientists to warn of an impending mass extinction event for the world's oceans.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ken Yoshikawa, Don Zurer, and Jennifer Kemp. The producer is Eric Takeoff. Special thanks to Mike Hoffman for helping Rosalind catch all her bees. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jinka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, Joe Uris hosts a discussion of the history of American relations with Iran, including the role of the military-industrial complex and how it relates to the current events. At 9, on Alternative Radio, agrarian reformer and author Wes